My name is Homer Venters. I work in the jail system of New York City. I have the great pleasure to work with Dr. McDonald, who's our fantastic medical director, and I wanted to talk a little bit about our investigations into and work on solitary confinement, an issue that we think is of vital importance for us as the people responsible for the health care in the jail system, but also as a vitally important issue of human rights, civil liberties, and autonomy for the millions of Americans who pass through jails and prisons every single year.
Sorry, Dr. Ventures, can everyone remember to do their disclosures before any statement? That's part of our CMP.
Before any editorialization. Yes, I have no disclosures to report. And you can just.
And you also want to say if you're representing the views of your organization or your own.
Sure, I represent Correctional Health, the Bureau of Correctional Health, for which I'm responsible, for New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. So here in, and so I'll just briefly get into a little background about solitary confinement and self-harm. We, in this talk today, are going to talk about self-harm, people hurting themselves while they're in jail. The self-harm is kind of a complicated phenomenon for those of you who aren't familiar with correctional settings. I'll talk a little bit about how it occurs. For those of you who are familiar with it, I think some of this will be familiar to you. We'll talk about our particular investigation into data that we have from our electronic health record, looking at how self-harm occurs in the New York City jail system among our patients. And then we'll summarize and talk a little bit about a path forward. So the jail system of New York City is quite large. It's the second largest in the nation. About 12,000 people on any given day, about 70 or so thousand admissions in a year, 12 jails, 9 of them on Rikers Island. The Bureau of Correctional Health is responsible for all aspects of health care in the jail setting in New York City, so unlike most places where you have a medical group that reports to ultimately the security authority, they may report to the Department of Correction or the Sheriff's Office. We work for the Department of Health, so it's designed to be an independent health authority. We have a newly implemented electronic health record, which we think is a vitally important tool, not just for providing higher quality care to individual patients, but for allowing the kind of aggregate analysis and promotion of human rights that we're going to talk about in a minute. So in 2012, we adopted a new framework to our clinical mission that incorporated human rights. So those two circles there, patient safety and population health, are things that we've always had. Patient safety being having good policies and procedures, having quality improvement, the kinds of things that all health systems talk about. Population health, the tools of epidemiology to follow disease trends, also vitally important and pretty familiar to most people in health settings. But human rights is new for correctional health in the United States. But we think it's of vital importance for us to really do our job well. And so we're going to talk in some other venues this week about how we work that into our operations in the jail system. But a couple of examples of why we think human rights is a vital component to our mission. One is a problem called dual loyalty, which is the notion that when you're a provider in a correctional setting, your mission to care for the person in front of you is eroded by the pressures of the security setting. And that's inexorable. It's not something you can eliminate, but it's something you should acknowledge, find, and try and mitigate. But one of the other areas that really prompted us to adopt the human rights mission or framework is the issue of solitary confinement. So I skipped one slide here because I just want to focus on this. When we get into the area of self-harm, and this is the main subject of the talk, people harm themselves in a lot of different ways in the jail system. If you look at the red dots on this, one of the common things we hear from patients is that once they've violated jail rules or been judged to have violated jail rules, they may then get an infraction, which is like a sentence, but it's a separate criminal justice system that occurs within the jail system, and they may be told that they're going to go into solitary confinement. At that point, they may harm themselves to avoid going into solitary confinement. They may do it because they're facing the stress of solitary confinement, they don't want to go. They may do it you know, depending on your perspective, because they want to get out of their punishment, and they think that the way to get out of that punishment or avoid that spot is to harm themselves. There are other red dots on that line, and these are the red dots that we theorize. This is a kind of a theoretical model that relate self-harm to solitary confinement. But again, this is kind of from clinical observations, so what we needed was a much more robust analysis of our data to see is that really true. Some other ideas about self-harm in our jail system. So patients will tell us that they get stressed out and they hurt themselves, and this is true in the community too, right? You have people that hurt themselves, that cut themselves, that do all sorts of things when they're stressed. People do say that they use it as a means to escape solitary. And they also say that they may hurt themselves once they get into solitary to, you know, deal with the new stress of solitary. So the reason that we're talking about self-harm and solitary together, aside from our clinical observations, what patients tell us, is we have two lines here, and on the dotted line, the red dotted line, has to do with the percentage of the jail that is dedicated to solitary confinement. And you see that's gone up quite steadily. It's almost doubled over a pretty short period of time. The blue line is the number of times people hurt themselves per year in the jail system. So those two things have gone up together quite considerably. And so, but this again goes as an observation. This is not our study. That these two things seem to have gotten worse in our setting. A couple other ideas about what people say about solitary. Mental health staff will often identify that people are hurting themselves to get out of solitary, but the way they're writing it is they're goal-directed, they're malingering, it's taking on really the language of the security force, right? It's that they're doing this. It's not legitimate. The Department of Corrections staff may call our solitary setting is called the Bing, one of them, and so people will call them Bing beaters. People who hurt themselves just to get away from their punishment. And, you know, from a medical standpoint, whatever you call them, people hurt themselves in trivial manners, and they also take their own lives in these acts of self-harm. So we took a look at almost 3 years of data from our electronic health record. Many, many different variables, looking at where people were, how they hurt themselves, the outcomes of their harm. And so just in brief, we had about 250,000 admissions during this time. That represented about 140,000 people. So people are coming back to jail, which is not a new notion for any of you, I'm sure. In that time, just under 3 years, with about 250,000 admissions, we had about 2,000 acts of self-harm representing just over 1,000 people. So just like people have recidivism in terms of returning to jail, people also hurt themselves multiple times in the jail setting. So this breaks out what the self-harm looks like from a clinical consequence. So we had about 2,000 acts of self-harm. Most of them are on the left blue bar there, the low lethality. And then you see some are over on the right, the high lethality. So the high lethality is just that, as judged by Dr. McDonald, myself, and some other clinical folks, things that could have led to your death. And we see that of the low lethality, most of them can be dealt with on-site. That means by a doctor in the jail. Some of them have to go out for you know, a little higher level of care, but maybe weren't of the consequence that it could have led to somebody's death. And then you can see a breakdown below of the types of self-harm that people engage in. I will say the most prolific single item in other is something that 2 years ago I don't think we would have thought about, but it's now a daily problem. It's people setting themselves or their cells on fire, which is every week we deal with like multiple fires in solitary settings, people wanting to get out. It's something that even when we started the study, I thought that must not really be a true thing, but it's actually quite a common phenomenon now in these settings. So I'll just work across, because now we're going to bring in, we talked a little bit about the self-harm, the overview. I'll basically just run you through these numbers. So 7% of the people who come to New York City jail system go into solitary confinement at some point. So 7% of people go into solitary. In that 7% of people who go into solitary, you find 53% of the acts of self-harm. So in the little bit of 7% of people who went into solitary, you have over half the self-harm. And in fact, you have over half the high lethality self-harm. And you have almost a third of the self-harm deaths. This histogram takes everybody's first act of self-harm. You may recall that there's a good number of people who had, a third of the people had more than one act of self-harm. So we just took everybody's first act of self-harm. And for the people who went into solitary, we plotted when they went into solitary against when they hurt themselves. And what we see is this very striking distribution right around the day of going into solitary confinement. So that it's not clear to us, because there's a lot of imperfect information on our side, we don't know if it's the anticipation of going into solitary or the physical conditions of being in solitary, but what is incredibly striking to us is in this population, this phenomenon is grouped very robustly around this practice. And then we did a regression analysis for the variables that we've been talking about, and briefly, the top section here has all of the self-harm, and the bottom section has the high lethality self-harm. So I've just highlighted what we think are the, in our regression model, important predictors of self-harm. And you can see that solitary confinement, having serious mental illness, and being young are all very important predictors of self-harm in our setting. Now, interestingly, when you go down to the bottom data, which is the high lethality self-harm, you still have serious mental illness and solitary confinement. I messed up the formatting there, but you see that the odds ratio is 7. So solitary and serious mental illness are strongly predictive. The age goes away, and so for some reason we have the adolescents hurt themselves at a very high rate. Like, young age is highly predictive of self-harm, but it's not highly predictive of high lethality self-harm. And we're still kind of thinking about what that means. So in summary, we have these two things that have increased for us quite a bit. In our clinical work, we have lots of self-harm, much more than we used to, almost twice as much as we used to over about a 5-year period. And then also the practice of solitary confinement is going up. Self-harm can result in mortality, that only 7% of inmates or patients go through solitary confinement. However, they represent 53% of all acts of self-harm and 57% of all acts of high lethality self-harm. And then the regression analysis reveals what we just saw. So this has led us to make recommendations to our superiors in the city government and our colleagues in the Department of Correction to make major modifications in how solitary confinement is used in our setting. We're engaged in that process. We've made headway in terms of creating new settings for people with serious mental illness. We still have a ways to go with adolescents and with people with mental illness, but not with the highest level of the serious mental illness. But it's a struggle that we believe is vitally important to our patients and also vitally important to our staff, who are the ones toiling in these very compromised settings. So thank you.